to breastfeeding our infants. The research on the value of breast milk is abundantly clear. At their very most critical stage of development, infants receive a nutritional benefit from breastfeeding that baby formula simply cannot replicate. And this is a finding that's been reached by the American Academy of Pediatrics, the World Health Organization, and others, as I expect you'll hear today. From a personal perspective, this bill is important because it will help make possible for our child to continue to receive the benefits of breast milk even after Liz has returned to work. And from a public policy perspective, this bill is about taking a small step, and I think it is a small step, that will have a large impact on public health. I urge you to support this bill. My testimony is very brief. I'd be happy to answer any questions, but I did want to share that perspective this morning.
Thank you, Representative Cannon. Any questions of Representative Cannon? Representative Maurer.
Yes, Madam Chair. Representative Cannon, thank you for coming. Question, where does your wife work?
She works at Gresham High School in the Gresham-Barlow School District.
Okay, so Gresham High School does not allow accommodate women today?
You know, I am not entirely sure what their policy is for women in her situation. I suspect that without this law, she would be able to find little cracks of space, whether between classes, at lunch, to express milk. I also expect that it's not the case for every woman in their job, that they're able to find those cracks of time. And it would certainly help her in a sort of negotiating position, or if there were any difficulties finding those times, it would help her to have this law and be able to show her administrators or others that she works with that, in fact, employers are required under the law to make this accommodation.
Follow up.
And
so the current law is that employers can make that accommodation, and I'm wondering, and I know you're a school teacher too, so I guess this is relevant. What's going to happen in those cracks of time to the classes that she's teaching? If this, you know, as a teacher, is that, do you think it would be an undue burden on the children not to have a teacher in the classroom, or how do you think that would work?
No, I don't. My assumption is that the school would find an accommodation. It is, of course, required to have a teacher in the classroom at all times. So it would, if it was necessary, to take that period of time, that rest period during a class period. And at Gresham-Barlow, at Gresham High School, they're an hour and a half long classes, so that may, in fact, be the case, that the school would provide one of its in-building subs. It's a large enough school, certainly has more than 25 employees, would provide one of its in-building subs for the 10 minutes, perhaps, that rest period lasts. So, yes, I would expect the school to make the accommodation to provide for a teacher at all times for the kids.
Okay. I think I'm not going to entertain any more questions because I know Representative Cannon has to go, and we want to hear the position. And then we have actually more people who have more information on this bill. So thank you, Representative
Cannon. And thank you, Chair Tomei, for making the accommodation to me this morning.
Good. And I know there's a physician in the back who wishes to speak, and if he will come up right now, I think it was a man, and we will let him testify on this bill, and then we will proceed with the rest of the agenda. Sorry. And if you could identify yourself, please. And if you would just leave that microphone right where it is, don't move it any closer. It will hear you just fine. Yes, you're fine.
Don't touch it.
For the record, I'm Jim Lace. I'm a pediatrician here in Salem. I represent the Oregon Medical Association and the Oregon Pediatric Society. And I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 2372. For those of you who weren't able to be here last session, we had introduced, along with the women, had an original bill that came through allowing women to breastfeed in workplaces and getting that whole concept across. This is a further expansion of that and further delineating that. I don't know. We've got two pieces of written testimony that you have, mine and also from another doctor. And I don't know if you want to hear all the details about why we want women to breastfeed, all the nutritional, psychological, you name it, everything that we can promote breastfeeding.
If we could hear that from you in a brief manner, that would be wonderful.
We'll just highlight the top points. Number one, decreased incidence in SIDS in moms who are breastfeeding. Number two, decreased incidence in life-threatening infections. Decreased incidence in obesity. As you all know, we have a huge problem in this state and other states with childhood obesity. And we'll tell you that there's anywhere from a 5 to 25% reduction in the incidence of obesity, childhood obesity in children who have been breastfed up to at least 6 months. So we want these moms to continue to breastfeed. You get an extra 5 IQ points if you've been breastfed for at least 6 months. These are all statistical studies. And so anyway, so nutritionally, immunologically, psychologically, overall development-wise, we want women to breastfeed. That is the best system that we have, and there's nothing else like that. If you go to developing countries, they breastfeed by default, usually up to a year or two. In this country, we have to fight to get this concept across. We have to promote that and come into the workplaces. I have an office where we have 45 employees. We have a room that's designated just for breastfeeding. It's also a rest area. We have 3 moms who are currently pumping. It doesn't take 10 minutes, by the way. I wanted to make sure that was clear about the testimony from the previous representative. This bill calls for a 30-minute break every 4 hours. It takes a little bit longer than 10 minutes to pump, just realistically, unless you're really super efficient. But it's just hard to do that. You need a room that's safe, that's clean, not toilets, not in a back room somewhere. You know, we've got all office chemicals, these kind of things. And then you're done. It should be a place that you can wash before and after and have access to safety. The basic thing is that we need to promote breastfeeding. How we do that as a society, we allow women to breastfeed in public. I think there's another bill coming up this session about, you know, allowing women not to feel like they're doing something that's illegal or immoral or somehow not, you know, that. We want to remind everybody that these are mammary glands. We are mammals, and we want women to breastfeed. And so anything we can do as a society to support that, we need to do that. So that's sort of the short bit of my testimony. There's more written in here on both sides. Both of the doctors, we're all in favor of this 100%. And if there's some changes that have to be made in the bill to accommodate that, that's fine. But whatever we can do to support women and support breastfeeding, we want to make sure we're on record as supporting that. And we want to make sure that we've extended ourselves out as a society to promote that.
Thank you. Will there be any other physicians testifying? I'm looking at Representative Berger and Diane Garrett.
There'll be 2 other people speaking about health benefits today.
Okay.
One's a nutritionist and one's a public health nurse.
Okay. I'm wondering about allowing questions here. Should we allow questions here, or will they be answered later?
You can ask.
That's your choice. Either way.
Okay. All right. All right. Okay. So any questions of this?
Just
yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doctor, in your testimony here that you have here in front of me, the third paragraph you have, currently you describe the 16% of children over the age of 2 are obese, and then you give a little bit more additional information on that.
Yes.
And then the following paragraph about where Oregon spends over $200 million treating diseases, could you provide me that referral or the evidence that you're referring
to? What we
that.
Did, this came out of last session, you know, when we started looking at the whole incidence of obesity, not in adult population only, but especially in children. What we did is we went through Marion Pope Community Health Plan, looked at the expenses that they have put out for our local health plan. I can't speak for Care Oregon, but I can speak for what we have here and our percentages, and then extrapolate that out to us as a state. So that's where this number comes from. But they actually have the numbers, and we can supply you with the numbers very easily on just how much money the state spends. We spend probably twice as much on meth right now, which is another big, you know, problem that we're all facing. But obesity is a huge problem that we have, and this is a cheap way to approach that. And if we can reduce the incidence of childhood obesity, you know, for basically not too much of a cost, certainly state tax dollars, we would like to support that. So it's a, to us, it's a very important thing. Plus the health benefits, they go on in terms of how kids are learning. You're going to hear different bills are going to come up about, you know, PE in school and things like this session that we're supporting. Last session we worked on the nutritional, you know, parts in schools and trying to get out the junk food, if you will, out of the cafeterias. This is, as a society, as we start to approach it, we can look at it sort of like we did with tobacco and come together, not just doctors, not just the government, but the public education, and say, how do you do this? Well, we need to do it as a group. We can't just come to you and say, hey, we need to do this and get away with it, and that's the end of it. We have to look at it and change consciousness and change our whole approach to that. And so this is one way to do that. Start off right out of the chute, if you will, with breastfeeding. Say, listen, if we can promote breastfeeding, and that will actually help to reduce the incidence of childhood obesity, then it's well worth our while. And if it means some potential, you know, things to employers, I mean, if it's going to cause undue hardship, as stated in the bill, my understanding is that they can look at some exemptions or something else out of that. But if we can promote that in any way we can, I think that's totally, you know, worthwhile from the medical standpoint. And if we can reduce obesity with that. So.
Okay.
Now, obesity, you have to remember, these are, if you look at, just to give you just a real quick overview on childhood obesity, we have the kids who have, you know, they're just a little overweight. Okay, we're not too excited about them. We get kids that get up above the 95th percentile on what we call the BMI, that's your body mass index. You and I, if we're over 30, we're considered obese. 25 to 30, we're kind of on the chunky side. Over 30, okay, now we're getting heavy. Over 40, then you're getting into what we call the super obese or the morbidly obese program. I have kids that are 50s. That's my, you know, my super clubs. They have BMIs of 55 and 60. 80% of those kids are going to end up with type 2 diabetes. It's a huge, huge hit. Now, what does that mean to you as a state? Well, you're spending tax dollars. Cataract, surgery, you know, hypertension, asthma, COPD, the list goes on, because so many of the times we end up having to support them because of their chronic illnesses. And so if we can reduce that in any way, I think it's, you know, money well spent.
Thank you. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your testimony today. Do you have access to studies, and maybe someone else will talk about this later today, the benefit to employers when infants are breastfed and the decreasing risk of childhood infection and illness? Is there any correlation to the number of days of missed work for a mother, a nursing mother who's caring for her infant versus a mother who's caring for an infant that is not breastfed?
If we can, well, there's a couple of things that can come out. Number one, if you keep mothers happy, you keep them working, they perform better, you know, in the job opportunity, they're, you know, less sick time for the child. The numbers we have, I mean, we can show studies that if you know, breastfeed, you will decrease the incidence of infections. If the mother doesn't have to stay home to take care of a sick child, she can work, then that will obviously help, you know, the workplace too. So the payoff is that she can breastfeed longer, she'll have a less likelihood of having a sick child, and hopefully will be able to work. That doesn't always come out for every single mom in every single situation, because kids are different. But as a general, if you look at population studies, we'll tell you that, yes, there will be a decreased incidence of infections, and the correlation should be that they will be decreased lost time, you know, in the workplace. So, and the other thing is, if we keep these moms, I mean, it's another way to make the moms want to work, you know, to come back and work, to feel positive, you know, about their workplace, because their workplace is providing them a place that they can pump. You know, it'd be nice somehow to have every workplace have daycare. Well, it's kind of expensive, and it's very hard to do that unless you get a big enough operation, and you can have your on-site daycare, and you can solve multiple issues that way. But most of us are not in that position to have on-site daycare, so we do the next best thing, which is, here's a room to pump, here you can do the breast milk, and when she's out of work at home, she can breastfeed the rest of the time. And so the idea would be to keep her happy, keep her healthy, keep the baby less sick, and ideally, in the long run, everybody will win in that situation. So.
Thank you.
Representative Maurer.
Yep, Madam Chair. Doctor, I'm sure you understand causal relationships.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if the research supports that breastfeeding is, in fact, a cause of reduction of obesity or just a factor associated with it.
Okay, that's a good question.
Because, I mean, we can make a causal relationship between smoking and lung cancer,
mm-hmm.
but I'm wondering if breastfeeding and reduced obesity, or is it because the lifestyles of the people that want to breastfeed are, you know, have other consequences that follow on?
Again, you have to look at how you use your statistics, okay? You could say, well, gosh, it's because they're breastfeeding and because they've made that commitment, they're going to have a healthier lifestyle, they can eat better and, you know, on the list. So, but if you take out all the covariables, you can just look at breastfeeding alone, just breast milk, and say you will have a decreased incidence of these infections. And so, yes, you can't just take that out.
Not infections, but obesity.
I don't know about that one. I'd have to look at that. Infections, I can tell you exactly. On the obesity issue, that may be a little harder to tease out and just say. And I quoted that range, you know, because you look at the studies and somebody says, well, gosh, there's no change. And other people say, oh, no, my gosh, there's a huge change with that. Well, one thing we can tell you is that if you breastfeed, you are not going to predispose your child to obesity. There's not a negative impact. It's only, you know, how you measure the positive impact.
Okay. So, thank you.
I have one comment. I'm hoping, and maybe in a work session, we can talk with, I'm sure there's other witnesses for this.
There are.
About, because I want to see this as a positive for business, not as a, you know, as a conflict.
Right.
And I think we need to explore that. But the only other comment I would make to the credibility of this witness, I have two points in his favor, and their names are Becky and Leanne. My kids.
They're physicians?
Yeah. Oh. Well, they were until we moved to Silverton. So nice to see you.
Thank you, Representative Lyon. Great. I see no more questions. I'm going to move on. Thank you so much for
coming.
Thank
you. Thank you very much.
Representative Berger, I know. Wait, can you wait just a sec? No, you can go.
Okay.
Traffic, I have two people. I have Mr. Nickel here to testify on another bill. And Representative Berger, we started out of line because Mr. Nickel wasn't here. Are you in a rush to leave?
No.
Oh, great. Do you mind if we take...
What's your timeline?
No, I think we'll hear Mr. Nickel and then we'll come back to this bill. Are you okay with that? Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing temporarily on House Bill 2372 and open up... Which one is he speaking on? Open up a work session on House Bill 2312. Mr. Nickel.
They should be up to just every listen.
Okay. Okay. Representative from OAC, you're here? Great, thank you. Yes.
Thank you, Chair. House Bill 2312 would amend the set of rights for persons who are committed by DHS at state facilities. It would create the right for individuals to be given daily access to fresh air in the outdoors. Similarly, and I'll just take
go
a
ahead,
chance if it's
ahead.
Okay, Chair.
Sure.
In a moment, I believe the Chair will be opening a work session on 2313, which is very similar, but it also creates the obligation for facilities to post the name, address, and telephone number of the Oregon Advocacy Center at treatment facilities.
Mr. Nickel.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bob Nickel. I'm Assistant Director for the Department of Human Services and the Addictions and Mental Health Division. My staff and I have had a chance to review the amendments on House Bill 2312, and we can work with that. So I wanted to put that on the record. I think the only concern that we've had about this is what significant risk is, but I have confidence that we can work that out in the process, and I'm relieved not to have to testify against access to the outdoors today.
Thank you, Mr. Nickel. Do you have anything to say, sir?
Madam Chair, my name is Bob Junda from Oregon Advocacy Center, and I believe on both 2312 and 2313, we've arrived at an agreement about the amendments. They seem to work for everyone. I think it's important to note that I've talked to representatives of community facilities as well as from the state hospital. And in each case, their concerns were that given physical plants that are make it difficult to bring people outside and some staffing problems that they wanted to make sure that they weren't put in a position of endangering their patients or other people, but that they're comfortable with the right being here as long as it's limited in that way. And so I think we have an understanding.
Did you identify yourself, sir?
Yes, I did. I'm Bob Junda
okay.
from Oregon
right.
Advocacy Center.
Okay, thank you. Yes, Representative Gelser.
I'd like to move adoption of the Dash 1 amendments that they discussed.
All right, everybody has those amendments at their place. Yes.
Thank you, Chair. Just to summarize, these amendments are available in the back here if anyone is interested. Proposed amendment 2312-1 would amend the proposed legislation to create, would basically limit the right for patients to access the outdoors in cases where significant risk of harm would be to that person or to others.
Thank you. And I'm assuming, Mr. Nickel, there is no fiscal impact if the amendment is adopted?
Madam Chair, that's correct. We do not believe there's a fiscal impact.
Great. Thank you. Any discussion? All right. Chair, Representative Gelser has moved the amendments.
I moved for the adoption of the amendments.
The adoption of the amendments to 2312. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye. Correct for the record, you should reference dash one so it's clear which amendment.
Okay.
Let her restate the motion.
Okay.
Yes, I would be happy to restate the motion. I would move adoption of the dash one amendments to House Bill 2312.
Thank you, Representative Gelser. Mm-hmm. Representative Gelser moved the dash one amendments to House Bill 2312. Any discussion? Would all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Nay.
Madam Chair, I would like to move Bill 2312 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gelser moves House Bill 2312 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. As amended, thank you. Any discussion? Will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Callen?
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Aye.
Representative Gillian?
Aye.
Representative Potek?
Excuse?
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Chair
Tomei? Aye. The bill passes unanimously. We'll go to the floor with the due pass recommendation. So I'm closing the work session on 2312. Okay, and I'm going to quickly open the work session on House Bill 2313.
Thank you, Chair. House Bill 2313, as I referenced earlier, would provide a similar right as 2312 of daily fresh air and access to the outdoors, but also requires the posting requirement of information about OAC at treatment facilities. I believe there might be a discussion of a proposed amendment. The proposed amendment dash 1 to 2313. If discussed, that amendment would limit the right also to in situations where significant risk of harm was created to the person or to others.
Thank you.
I'd like to move adoption of the dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2313.
Representative Gelser moves the dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2313. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Seeing none?
Yes.
Amendments carried. Thank you. Unanimously.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House Bill 2313 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gelser moves that House Bill 2313 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Thank you, gentlemen. You've done a great job. Thank you so much. The clerk, that's all, right? So the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Representative
Gelser?
Aye.
Representative Gillian?
Aye.
Representative
Potek?
Excused.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative
Olson?
Aye.
Chair
Tomei? Aye. The House Bill 23, as amended, passes and goes to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Thank you. That was great. And thanks to all who worked on that, including both the gentleman who spoke today and other people who worked on this bill. It's wonderful to see it go through. And with support from everybody. Thank you. Okay, I'm going to open up the public hearing again on House Bill 2372. Oh, I'm supposed to have somebody carry that bill. So do I have
right.
to open up the public
hearing?
You should
open up the work session
okay.
on both, actually.
I open up the work session on 2312 Would anyone like to volunteer to carry it? I see Representative Olson smiling.
Absolutely.
All right.
Which one, 2312 or 13?
We've opened it on 2312.
So. Just 2312.
Oh, absolutely.
All right. Representative Olson will carry it. I close the work session on 2312, open the work session on 2313. Do you want to carry that one too?
Oh, absolutely.
All right. Representative Olson will carry 2313 to the floor, and I close work session on House Bill 2313, and I open up the House Bill, the public hearing on House Bill 2372. So, do you both want to come up at the same time?
Right.
Okay, great. Come on up.
I found a senator one.
No.
On this side of the building?
It's like a 1-2 punch.
Great. Thank you.
How you do, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Vicki Berger, State Representative, District 20. Happy to be here to and proud to be a co-sponsor of this bill. I will speak very briefly, kind of philosophically, what brought me to this bill and what I see as why this bill and why now, and then let the experts talk about experts. A little known fact about me is that I have an undergraduate degree in anthropology. And I'm really interested in sort of the whole history of humankind, and that's what got me to that degree. Believe me, there's a connection, because looking historically, women and babies have always worked together, because that's how it works. As the good doctor mentioned, we are mammals. We're called mammals for a reason, and babies need their mothers. They always have. And up until about 150 years ago, that was just a given. Mothers worked. The mothers always work, but they had their babies with them. And in the Industrial Revolution, suddenly that dynamic was terribly upset, because they are working in a workplace where babies just don't do well. And we've sort of struggled with that ever since. And we continue to struggle with that dynamic, because mothers and babies still need each other. Going back a generation ago, when my mother came out of the war, where women were working in industrial jobs, they all ran home and had babies. And they had babies at home. And they had a very different, I think, outlook on the whole breastfeeding thing. It wasn't modern. My generation came along and realized modern has nothing to do with it. It has to do with what's best for babies. And I could not get more telling testimony than Dr. Lace and his discussion of what's best for babies. So where are we now? I think right now we have a unique opportunity to rethink this. Two things converge here in modern America. One is mothers have to work. I don't know very many families that can make it with children on one income, which means mothers are an important part of our workforce, and to cut them out completely in the early childhood years from work is wrong-headed, particularly when the economic needs of the family, is real. Employers need good workers. That's the other piece of this equation. The employers, I know, have heartburn over this, but it's a workforce issue. They need these good workers, and they need to accommodate the unique circumstances that only last for a small portion of that worker's lifetime, but it's a really important portion if you look at the history of the family and how the family functions. The other thing that's new is technological, that changes the whole dynamic here, and that's the breast pump. It used to be that a nursing mother had limited opportunity to actually accommodate the baby when she didn't have the baby absolutely with her. We have a technology, and this was brought home to me with my own daughter, who was a teacher and was a nursing mother at the same time. And when I saw that thing, I said, that is a whole different kettle of fish. It makes it possible for nursing mothers to work in a way that wasn't open to me and hasn't been open for mothers since the Industrial Revolution. So this is a very minor thing. It's been blown into some huge workforce stringent thing. Remember that mothers need to work and babies need this nutrition. And you put the two together and nobody wants their baby's breast milk to come out of the bathroom. We're just asking for an accommodation that is cleaner and better because you can't do this under a stressful situation. And it doesn't have to be anything fancy. It just has to be clean and have a plug. Is that so much? And a little bit of privacy and a quiet moment. And as the doctor indicated, it isn't some long, complicated process. It's very simple because the technology makes it possible. So I would encourage you to look at this bill for what it is. It's a way of getting mothers and babies back together at a time when we really need that to happen. And I thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions of the representative? Seeing none. Thank you so much. Senator.
Thank you.
Hard act to follow.
For the record, my name is Ginny Burdick, and I am in the State Senate, and I represent the people of Senate District 18 in Southwest Portland, Tigard, and King City. My breastfed baby is in college right now, but I have no less passion than I did at the time that I was actually a nursing mom. It was one of the most rewarding experiences of my life, in part because I could see what it was doing for my baby. My baby was born premature. She weighed just a little over 4 pounds, but she became a nursing baby very quickly. And I worked during the 2.5 years that I nursed her, but I never had to miss one day of work for a sick baby call because my daughter never went to the doctor except for routine checkups because the nursing kept her. And I went through colds, she went through colds, but everything was so mild because she had that natural immunity. And she grew up into a wonderful, healthy, strong young woman, and I'm extremely proud of her. This is the fourth time I've supported this bill before the legislature as both a nursing mom and a working mom, although some might argue with that at times. Working mothers and all women of childbearing age deserve all of our support as a society to combine what Representative Berger very articulately described as the tension between work life and family life. No mother and no family should ever have to decide between reducing her child's risk for diabetes, weight problems, and childhood cancers by breastfeeding or returning to work. We don't want her to delay her return to work because of its impact on families, and we certainly don't want her to decide not to return at all because of lack of support. We don't want to force moms to choose between their baby and their family. This bill is an important first step in recognizing the need to provide employees with emotional as well as physical support for breastfeeding in the workplace. New mothers will be more likely to return to work if they feel there is support and they see it in action. And as Representative Berger very clearly stated, these are not major things. We are not looking at a situation where we are going to see nursing mothers on the rampage looking for new buildings to be constructed to allow them to pump for their job. We're looking at very modest, minor accommodations. House Bill 2372, which I'm proud to be a co-sponsor of, is a win-win proposal for businesses. Supporting nursing moms would more than pay for itself economically, not only increase well-being of the mother and baby, but in less time off from work to take care of sick children. The result is reduced absenteeism, reduced health care costs, and happier employees. Now, who could argue with that? I urge your support for House Bill 2372, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions of either the senator or the representative? Oh, you're off lucky. Thank you so much for coming to testify.
Thank you.
Should I call the three of them at once? Okay. Diane Garrett, Marion Rice, and Tammy Lindsley. Sorry.
Okay.
My name is Diane Garrett. I am a volunteer breastfeeding peer counselor and an advocate with Nursing Mothers Council, Chair Tomei, and members of the committee. I cannot convey enough of my gratitude that you will hear this bill and hear these stories today. I'm deeply grateful. As you already know, we are here today to ask for your help in raising breastfeeding duration rates in Oregon. Most people have heard about the benefits of breastfeeding, but unfortunately, we still live in a culture where infants are primarily fed formula, which, try as we might, still does not add up to infant health. Only 1 in 4 Oregon babies are exclusively breastfed for the first 6 months of life. It's even more grim nationally. It's 1 in 10. So clearly, we are not a breastfeeding culture. We are a culture that gives a substitute, and we're trying to change that. Women who do decide to breastfeed in our culture often face unique challenges and sometimes social stigmas for just trying to give their kids a healthy start in life. And in particular, women who would like to integrate work and breastfeeding are often not able to meet that goal. And so they stop breastfeeding because they need their paycheck. And that is a very difficult and grievous choice that we can begin to rectify with this bill. House Bill 2372 is a measured step in this direction. It amends existing language that was passed last session in Senate Bill 618. The language was placed in ORS 653, which is wage and rest period statutes. As Senator Burdick said, this is the fourth time the concept has come before the legislature, so we feel there has been opportunity for a very full conversation with all interested parties. We feel that the language of the bill is the result of positive dialogue and feedback. As you know, the three main components of the bill are time, location, and remedy. So the time is, unless otherwise agreed, 30 minutes during each four-hour work segment. And this is because it matches very closely with the biological needs of a baby to eat about every 3 hours. And a pumping session usually takes about 20 minutes, and that's evidence-based and experientially based number. And then about 5 minutes for setup, cleanup, get back to work. So a little bit of travel time. The location is a private location other than a bathroom stall. Now, I just want to make clear that obviously a bathroom stall is not our first choice. The bill does not prohibit the use of a bathroom stall, but it says you must make reasonable efforts. So obviously it's an unsanitary option, but we are not saying that it is not available. And the remedy is administered through BOLI. The penalty provisions are the same as any other rest period violation. We're not reinventing the wheel. We're just kind of trying to plug in with other rest period wording that's already present. And businesses can appeal to reasonable efforts and undue hardship. We understand that not every work situation is feasible, and that mom is going to have to adjust her breastfeeding goals. And we are trying to make allowance for that in the bill. What I just want to do now is very quickly show you some statistics that you can review more in depth at another time, but I wanted to give you a sense of the size of firm, 25 and up. Who is that? Where is that? So I have an overall sheet that shows it would apply to 10% of Oregon employers. 90% would be exempt. So in round numbers, that's 13,000 employers were asking to make this accommodation. The other 112,000 can ignore this bill. Now, obviously, we would hope that they would do the right thing and help their breastfeeding employee, but they do not have a requirement on them. This page simply shows you size of firm by county, so that can be helpful for you in understanding where are these businesses. And then when you put that alongside where babies are born in Oregon by county, you can kind of get a sense of where the size of firms are, where the babies are being born, what's the likelihood of constellations of throughout the state, where accommodations would be most likely to occur. And then the last is a few pages of where women of childbearing age are in the work sector. So just even on the first page, for example, you know, we're looking at the manufacturing sector, ages 14 to 44 is considered childbearing age. There's 15% of the workforce in that sector is ages 14 to 44. So you can go through and see where it will be most likely. What workplaces are going to have to pay attention to this sporadically, and what workplaces are more likely to have to accommodate women more on a more regular basis. So those learnings are for you to look at. I also wanted to point out that we are engaged in a national dialogue about how is the country going to address a strategy to improve workplace conditions. There are 8 other states that have passed legislation, and I have included the text from those states in the packet for you to look at. And as you can see, you know, by far we have the most detailed description here in House Bill 2372, and I would expect this to set the standard for the country should this pass, and I would be so pleased to have that happen. And then finally, there are, you guys already have these sheets, but you know what breastfeeding looks like in the United States. That's kind of not happening. So with that, I will just simply make myself available for any questions about bill content, and then would like to simply allow other people to tell their stories. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Garrett. Any questions of Ms. Garrett? Right, thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry.
Sorry, Madam Chair.
Sure.
First off, I want to thank Diane for her efforts, and regardless of where this all falls out on my part, I mean, you've been a trooper, and it's obvious your homework is very thorough, and so she should be congratulated on that. I have several questions, and this all gets back to the hardship on business, and my thought or belief is that we should use a carrot rather than a stick, and I know that you believe that the carrot has not worked. And have you reviewed Texas's program? I know Oregon has a program for breastfeeding recognition, and Texas also has one. But Texas goes a step further and recognizes businesses to allow them to put on their literature for workforce hiring employment to say, you know, we are mother friendly or breastfeeding, whatever.
Mother friendly.
Yes. And and so, you know, I guess that's where I would like this argument to go is go another further step in the carrot before we throw the hammer down. And so. But another part of this, actually the question is the hardship part. And I listened to Representative Cannon speak about being a teacher. And I had thought about that situation as I thought, well, you know, a school could say, you know, this is really an unreasonable or undue hardship on us because we can't leave the kids alone in the room. And I can easily see a district that doesn't have an in-house substitute every day, you know, claiming that that's an undue hardship. And so it gets back, who's the arbiter of this, and where do they fall out? Do you have any thoughts about this undue hardship clause and making reasonable efforts? Go ahead, Diane.
Representative Maurer, thank you for your thoughtful questions. I believe that we put the undue hardship language in there because we intend for it to be used. We intend for businesses for whom this is not feasible to make that known if an employee, if there's not a workable situation with the employee. So we have provided a way for employers to be exempted from this. I mean, I happen to think that we're all pretty creative people, and if we put our heads together in an open and compassionate way, we can figure this stuff out. And I understand that in particularly in rural communities, probably the largest employers are going to be healthcare and education. So you've got two work settings that are time sensitive, they're people sensitive in that way, and we want to remain sensitive to that. I'm pleased that Catherine Bradley from DHS is here today and would like to allow her to talk about the DHS designation program and how that's going. And I was told the Labor Commissioner is here.
I see him.
Okay. And I would just like to encourage you to pose some of those questions to him as to how Boley envisions itself approaching issues that need to be mediated.
Okay. Thank you. And follow on?
Follow up.
Thank you. Also, in the bill, on the back page, it says the section applies only to an employer whose employee is expressing milk for a child 18 months of age or younger. I guess you can open that up and say, well, I prefer that it's my own child that we're making these accommodations for instead of essentially wet nurse. That we're doing it for your child, and that this is not a side business. That and I know you may not have thought about that in the extreme, but I somehow to identify that for its, whether it's a biological or an adopted child, but that it's your own child.
If I understand you correctly, you're expressing the concern that this language is a little ambiguous around whose child you would be expressing milk for.
Is that, have you thought of that, or is that?
I honestly hadn't thought of that because wet nursing is not really a cultural norm in our society. So it's not something that's.
My wife was in the Wenatchee League in Tennessee, and to be quite honest, that was. An issue, or small, but it was an issue. So,
great.
And then I'm going to stop.
Okay, thank you. And we're going to move on because we've got lots of people here who want to testify. So, if who would like to be next?
I will.
Okay.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, my name is Dr. Marion Rice, and I live at 3938 North Overlook Boulevard in Portland, Oregon. I'm a member of the Nursing Mothers Council. I support the legislative measure being heard today, 2372. I've been working in my position as Senior Director of Education with a nonprofit public service media company for about 7 years before starting a family. After becoming pregnant, I made arrangements to take maternity leave and return when my son was 3 months old. I was dedicated to my job. I wanted to be very productive at work, excited to be going back to a very rewarding career, but also wanting to do what was best for my son, and that was to breastfeed him as long as possible. I didn't want to create any personally uncomfortable situations with fellow employees around milk storage, so I had the means to, and I bought my own little refrigerator for my office. My position at the company afforded me a closed-door office in close proximity to a sink across the hallway. However, my office had large glass windows that opened into a public hallway. The company's designated pumping room was not available on a consistent basis, nor was it possible to store any pump supplies there. It was actually an edit suite and a makeup room, and was highly trafficked by other employees and people renting the facilities. It was also two floors down from my office. Knowing that I would be pumping 4 to 5 times a day to keep up my milk supply, I felt that the constant packing up of my pump and going up and down for pump breaks would be a deterrent to continuing to breastfeed my child. I was aware that these constant interruptions would make it difficult for my fellow employees to schedule meetings or calls with me. For work efficiency reasons and for lack of a reasonably available pumping room, I requested blinds for my office. One side of the building had offices with similar glass walls, and those employees had blinds. I didn't think this would be a problem. The answer from facilities was a quick no. I suggested that perhaps I could purchase the blinds and put them up, but that was also denied. I asked if my direct supervisor had been advised of this decision and was told not to discuss this with him. Eventually, I put up work-related posters up on the glass to secure some privacy. While I figured out a workaround, other employees were not so lucky because they worked in cubes. Before speaking to you today, I received permission from two of my fellow employees to tell you that they stopped nursing because pumping at work was so stressful. They felt that they weren't being productive enough at work and feared that continuing to pump would mean they would lose their jobs. Another colleague was lucky enough to inherit a closed-door office complete with blinds during her pregnancy, and she had a very supportive supervisor. Since I was not nursing a baby at the time, I lent her my refrigerator to store her pumped milk. She could take conference calls, answer email, and maintain a very productive workday. Months later, there were large-scale space reconfigurations at the office, and the employee was moved back to a cube. She told me that when she brought up the lack of privacy necessary for expressing breast milk to facilities, she was told to use the designated pumping room. The employee informed facilities that the designated room was in fact being used for other purposes on a regular basis and often not available. Facilities suggested she pump in the bathroom or ask other people if she could use their office. When I heard about this unfortunate exchange, I was on maternity leave after the birth of my second child. I sent email to Human Resources. In the email, I offered to get a group of nursing or soon-to-be nursing mothers, nursing employees, to brainstorm ways that the organization could support nursing mothers. I also sent along the PDF file of the State of Oregon Breastfeeding-Friendly Employer Program brochure. The response to this suggestion from Human Resources was, "Thanks for your good intentions. I will review." There was never any follow-up to my suggestion. Sadly enough, the nursing mother who was being moved to a cube ultimately elected to leave the organization. This company made more concessions for people who smoke than women who need for a time to express breast milk. Smokers at this company are provided a permanently designated area to smoke and regular smoking breaks. The contrast was striking. Breastfeeding has so many positive health effects for the mother and the child. While the support of smoking at the workplace has a detrimental health effect on the individual and all the people in the organization, bear in mind that this company was not a stereotypical big business. It was a large, well-funded nonprofit whose work centered on public welfare. If breastfeeding issues are a problem in such an organization as this, I invite you to ponder the depth of the problem in Oregon. After almost 10 years of service to this company, while on maternity leave with my second child, I was offered and accepted a position with a new company, and am now in a situation where the support for nursing mothers and employee welfare is wonderful. Everyone wants to do the right thing to support families and future generations. I urge you to pass this bill in support of nursing mothers and Oregon's future generations. It just won't happen on its own. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any quick questions of Dr. Rice? Thank you, Dr. Rice.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Tammy Lindsley, and I'm from Mount Angel. I'm here in support of Legislative Measure 2372. I currently work as a breastfeeding peer counselor for the Marion County WIC program. I'm a former breastfeeding mother who both nursed at home and pumped milk at work for my two children. They're now ages 5 and 7 years old. I provide on-call breastfeeding counseling and support services for women needing assistance with breastfeeding during the first 4 to 6 postnatal months. The goal of this work is to keep as many mom and baby pairs breastfeeding as possible, with the understanding that the health and financial benefits are worth the time and financial investments. I'm a privately contracted consultant and not a Marion County employee, and to clarify, I'm speaking today as a private citizen for my personal experiences, not on behalf of Marion County. I think it's important to make that distinction. I spent 7 years speaking with other moms from all over the world via the internet about breastfeeding issues, including issues unique to moms who must return to work but need to be able to pump breast milk for their babies. I was very lucky during my times of breastfeeding and pumping for my babies. Many of the WIC mothers that I work with on a daily basis do not have the perks that I enjoyed in order to provide milk for my babies. I feel fortunate to have found my current work with WIC. It has been very rewarding to work with clients and open up the lines of communication and increase public education and awareness about breastfeeding. My own pumping experiences were, at the time I worked here in Salem as a public school teacher for 24J. I had supervisors who were flexible and allowed me to arrange my teaching schedule to make time for pumping for my infants. And to clarify with the teacher situation, it was in middle school, and I understand that in elementary classrooms that may be a little bit more difficult to make those accommodations. I had a classroom in which to pump. If the classroom had not been available at the time, there were several other rooms with locking doors available nearby. I had a place to store my expressed milk and my pumping equipment. I had a sink in my classroom to wash the equipment. And I brought a borrowed demo pump from WIC today if anybody wants to have an idea of what equipment needs to be washed. I think that might be kind of a nebulous term for folks that haven't looked at it. It's just a few parts, but the point is they need to be washed off in between uses. In my current work with WIC, I have found that typical WIC moms are working in entry-level jobs. Their employers are much less likely to have an understanding of pumping moms' needs for space, privacy, time, sanitation. Pumping apparatus, as I said before, requires a sink with running water or a microwave to use sterilization bags for pumping parts. Kind of back to that technology piece, we don't necessarily have to have running water, but we have to have a microwave, so one or the other. WIC moms might be relegated to pumping in bathroom stalls, among other places, for lack of time and space to set up properly. And I think we've already gone over the part about the baby's lunch being prepared in a bathroom. Pumping in a car is possible. During the winter months, it's probably not the most conducive to pumping effectively, keeping up your nursing relationship. Also, if there's, you know, space between where you're working and where your car is, the travel time may take up all of your pumping break. WIC moms, on average, may not have the self-advocacy experience or skills to be able to advocate for themselves to get what they need in this respect. They may not have a strong relationship with their employer that is needed to foster the employer's patience for the ongoing months of pumping. A mom who pumps successfully may continue to do that for some time after her return to work. I've talked to a lot of moms who the employer says, yes, you can pump, yes, you can have the time, yes, you can have the space. And after about 6 weeks of it, the employer says, you're still doing this? And the whole point of doing it is so that you can continue to nurse for some time for the baby's health and for the mom's health. In the last 1.5 years, I've worked with dozens of WIC moms in the WIC program as they've transitioned from early postpartum full-time nursing back to part or full-time working. And I've helped them as they've juggled pumping, childcare, taking care of their children, taking care of their homes. I don't think there's any question that moms tend to have lots of jobs. Some moms worked in very entry-level jobs, while a few have actually worked in higher career-level, career-focused positions. I have had clients who worked for state agencies, and those clients were concerned about working out a pumping schedule with their direct supervisors. And I feel the need to point out, in the end, those clients that were in that situation actually turned out they worked out something very positive and it was okay. But they were worried about talking to their employers when they went back. I was surprised at my clients' trepidation when I first started because, as I stated above, I had been quite fortunate in my personal pumping circumstances. Working with these clients has been an eye-opener for me. Based upon my experiences with my clients, I believe that the paradigm of a working, nursing, pumping mom does not seem to be established among Oregon employers. It seems that sometimes there isn't even a comfortable vocabulary for employees and employers to be able to talk to one another about this. They can't talk to, moms tend to not be able to talk to their supervisors. Our culture seems to work really hard to separate our work and our personal lives, but this is an instance where we need to find balance between those two things. And again, I think it goes back to moms have lots of jobs. When a mom is at work, that's not the only thing she's doing. She's thinking about her family. Understandably, the transition to a pumping-friendly workplace may be awkward at times. Perhaps employers will have initial difficulties with scheduling and providing places for moms to pump. I believe that in a new and improved pumping-friendly workplace, we will find higher breastfeeding rates along with better health for babies, better health for moms, and stronger family attachments between parents and children here in Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify here today, and I would be happy to answer questions.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Thank you, ladies, especially Diane.
I'm sorry, one last question. This is for Diane. In your little sheet, it says the employee must inform her employer of her intent.
Yes.
And I don't see that, but maybe you can point that out to me. I mean, and it may be an issue of rules, but...
It's under Section 1. It would be line 12 in the bill. It says the employee shall notify the employer that the employee intends to express no compliance.
Sorry,
change.
Thank
Is
you.
That what you're referring
to? Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Please, I think I have these tattooed on my eyelids, too.
Okay.
Thank you. I'm sorry for the confusion of these meetings today. We have more people here to testify than we had anticipated. So I am going to temporarily close the public hearing on this because we have some people here to testify on House Bill 2464, and I want to make sure that they have time to testify, and then we'll come back to this hearing. So I'm sorry if it's confusing, but we are going to temporarily close the public hearing on House Bill 23. Oh, I'm sorry. Before we do this, Dan Gardner is here, and I'm going to let Dan Gardner speak, and then we are going to close that hearing. So thank you, Mr. Gardner. He's also my constituent.
Oh, my.
Proud to have you as my state representative.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and also a father of two teenage children who were breastfed. I strongly support the passage of House Bill 2372 as a much-needed improvement over Senate Bill 618 that passed the legislature last session. I'd really be proud for Oregon to be added to the list of the 12 states, including our neighboring states of California and Washington, that have already enacted legislation regarding an employee's breastfeeding needs during the workday and how to humanely provide basic accommodations for breastfeeding mothers. Approximately 40,000 Oregon women give birth each year. According to the Congressional Research Service, 60 to 70% of the women go back to work within 3 months after giving birth. And according to the State Health Department, 88% of Oregon women mothers choose to breastfeed. In the 99 session, the legislature passed a bill that would require state agencies to accommodate employees who are breastfeeding infants. Expanding this protection to the private sector is a logical next step. Although most women are educated in the benefits of breastfeeding, moms are struggling with implementing this in practice upon returning to work. Unfortunately, numerous studies show that when women return to work, that they are less likely to continue breastfeeding. Within 6 months after giving birth, the percentage of employed mothers who are breastfeeding lags behind that of non-employed mothers by 25%, mostly for the challenges they faced by breastfeeding mothers in the workplace, a lack of a flexible work schedule, lack of a place to pump, and concerns about support from their employer. The raising of breastfeeding duration rates, we have to change the workplace conditions for new moms, and it's not happening fast enough with the motivational model we've been using. Quite frankly, the beneficial impact of breastfeeding upon public health, we feel that any inconvenience to business might experience is far outweighed by the public health benefit. Studies show that companies save money on health care costs for their employees and their children and stay healthier when breastfeeding mothers are accommodated in the workplace, providing an additional economic benefit from this legislation. We know Oregon needs a healthy workforce to prosper, and we know that legislation supporting family-friendly values in the workplace is necessary. The Bureau would also like to emphasize that compliance with this measure will be done through basic training through our Technical Assistance for Employers Unit. Our method of enforcement really is to try to get employers in compliance, even those that we currently get violations on meals and rest periods. We don't go out and find immediately. That's not our mode of operation. We send a demand letter telling them what the law is, what the complaint is, and ask them for an answer to that complaint. Our goal is to get them in compliance. We actually don't find anyone on this particular area of law unless they've had three violations within about a one to two year period. And that's really an employer who's not listening. And, that very, very rarely ever happens. And we'd much rather work with the employers to get them into compliance. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any questions of Commissioner Gardner?
I have some, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Mr. Commissioner, good to see you there.
Thank you.
I'm just curious, and I've got a series of questions, and maybe you can help me out here. How do you see this impacting temporary employment?
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, how I see it affecting temporary employment. I mean, it would depend on the particular type of temporary employment. For instance, if you've got someone who's an employer who's used to having temporary employees and has other employees in the workplace, it'd be easy to accommodate. We're only talking about employers who have 25 or more employees. So, I mean, if you're only employing one temporary employee and they're not directly working for that employer but for a subcontractor, more than likely we'd have to deal with that rule, but I doubt they'd have to accommodate for a temporary employee who's working through an employment agency, mm-hmm. if that's what you mean.
Yeah, that's kind of where I was going at. Another question. Yeah, thank you. Follow up. Thank you. She's going to make me do push-ups later on tonight. I got that feeling.
Well, in the district, she does calisthenics weekly.
You know, with my background and everything, having been law enforcement and everything, I know that Diane Garrett and I, we had this discussion before too, but I'm just curious your thoughts on this. How do you see this fitting for like EMS, emergency services, fire, and police? Because I see that as, wow, being a real can of worms almost.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Olson, with, you know, with fire and police and EMS, very rarely with emergency services, for instance, ambulance drivers, EMTs, you rarely have a situation where it takes longer than a four-hour period. It has to be a pretty catastrophic situation for that. Most of them would be picking up someone at their home that may have had a heart attack or an injury in the home. Occasionally it's a car wreck, but usually that individual EMT will be with one patient, you know, working with them for extraction and then transport to the hospital. I don't see where that would have effect. With police and fire, again, police responding to certain situations, the dispatcher, you know, they rarely have a situation where they have to deal with more than a four-hour period. You know, unless you've got some sort of a hostage situation, perhaps, and even in that, there's enough other officers to be able to do some breaks, I would imagine. And it would be so rare that that would happen. In a fire situation, now that could last a much longer period. That's where you have to have a large enough employment, which is 25 employees or more, where in your small rural districts it would not apply, but in your larger districts it would, and they would have enough employees to break that person out to give them the opportunity.
A follow-up and a comment, Madam Chair. So I'm staying in compliance, sir. Well, from my experience, I know that there are a number of instances that you exceed beyond a four-hour time period, being involved in investigations and that type of thing, and just depending on what the incident is. That's my comment. A further question that I have deals with referring to ORS 653020, subsection 3, which is identified in the bill. And it describes an individual engaged in administrative, executive, or professional work who, A, performs predominantly intellectual, managerial, or creative tasks, B, exercises discretion and independent judgment, and C, earns a salary and is paid on a salary basis. How do you see that working, this whole bill working for businesses that are within the agricultural environment?
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, I have to tell you, I haven't really thought about that. In the agricultural industry, I mean, again, in any workplace, you're allowed to have a 10-minute rest period within within 4 hours of work. All this is allowing that extension of that particular period. We only allow, in extreme circumstances and only on a one-day basis, for any deviation from that for any employee in the state. So if anyone's violating that beyond that point, they're currently violating current law as written. All this does is allows the extension of that time a little bit longer to allow the expression of breast milk. So
just a follow-up. So what I'm hearing you say then is that under this statute that's referred to on line 26 of the bill on page 2, ORS 653020 subsection 3, that also applies toward agriculture farm workers.
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, in the early part of my term, there was an exclusion in administrative rule for farm workers that I, held a work group on. It was removed, and all meal and rest period law now currently applies to farm workers as well as every other worker in the state.
I'm really confused with the language then in subsection 3 that this is referred to, because I just don't get reading that would apply toward agriculture.
And we can discuss this during the work session.
Okay, very good.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Olson, I'd be happy to take a look at subsection 3 and answer that question after doing a little research.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And would you give that to, maybe give it to staff, and then he can disseminate it to the full committee.
Be happy to do that.
Any other questions of Commissioner? Yes.
Yes, Madam Chair. First one is on the front page about the employee intent. And I guess I could see a scenario where an employer is antagonistic in this situation and delays, and so that the mother, in effect, loses that right or loses that ability. And so I think it would be very helpful, whether it's in the rule or in statute, that the employee has at least some nominal obligation to inform the employer in time for them to make the accommodation, whether physically, probably physically in most cases, to make the accommodation.
You know what I would like to suggest, Representative Meyer, that we pose these questions to Commissioner Gardner, and we're going to have another hearing, and we could pose as many questions as we want, and he will get back to us, I assume you will,
absolutely,
and come with answers. So let's not expect him to have answers now, because I expect some of these, as the previous questioner posed. So go ahead with your question.
No, and all the rest of the questions I can put in a writing or written form and to allow you some time.
That would be perfect.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative, the one thing I would say is that our intent is in the rulemaking process to bring not only the proponents of the bill together, but organizations like Associated Oregon Industry, Oregon Business Association, and FIB, and try to make rules that work for everybody. We try to make them in a very collaborative manner.
Okay.
Representative Gilliam, I know you have some questions, too. Would you be willing to put these in writing for Commissioner Gardner?
Yes, I would.
Great. Any other questions?
I'd be happy to pass that test later.
Thank you, Commissioner. And with that, I am briefly going to close this hearing on House Bill 2464, but we will get back to it, so stick around. I'm sorry?
Close at 2372 and open 2462.
Okay, I'm closing 2372 and opening up 2464. And so we have Sue Neal, Ross Ryan, Joanne Furman, and Buddy, whose last name I can't pronounce, Budenschnatz? Budenschnatz. I wasn't too bad. So maybe we can pull up a fourth chair here with these folks. And thank you so much for waiting. I know you've been here since before 8:30. And it's a tedious process to sit through, so thank you so much. Thank you, Susan. Okay, and staff is going to give us a quick summary, and then we'll ask you to introduce yourselves and tell us just the town where you live. And then we'll hear your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. House Bill 2464 would direct the Department of Human Services to adopt rules that would allow persons with developmental disabilities to retain monthly earned income while still at the same time maintaining their eligibility for state medical assistance and placement in residential settings.
Thank you so much for coming. Who would like to be first? Let's see, I think I gave Sue's name first. Are you Sue?
Yeah.
Would you like to speak to us, Sue? Yeah. Thank you.
I'll rest Sue and I'll read her statement.
All right. Could you bring the microphone over here just a little bit closer to you? No, you can just sit there and just bring it over closer to you. That's great. Susan, you'll let us know if you can't hear.
Okay. Honorable Chairperson and committee members, my name is Sue Neal. I work for Goodwill Industries, sorting and hanging clothes for resale. I earn about $130 a month. Of that, I have to pay an offset to Polk County of $80 each month. Of what is left, I also have to pay for my over-the-counter medications and any other medical needs that the Oregon Health Plan does not cover. I often do not have any access to the money I earn to do the simple things others enjoy. I would like to take a vacation, but I know that I have to save my money for special trips. If I have to give up my paycheck, I will not be able to do or have the things I like. I also know you would not work for free, and I should not have to work for free either.
Great.
Is that right?
Good. Thank you, Sue. Uh-huh. Do you have anything to add to that, Sue?
Uh-uh.
All right. Thank you. Now we have Ross.
Hi, my name is Ross Ryan, and I live in Mount Angel. And I'm testifying on the offset. And I have a little story on this.
Great, Ross.
And I will start out with my name is Ross Ryan. I live in Mount Angel, Oregon. I work as a janitor. I make under $300 most of the time. And I have not to have paid offsets before because I was in silk. I know I have to move to the new system called supportive living. I would have to pay off as such. I do not make much money. I never had enough money to pay my bills and have fun now. If the state takes my money will not be able to pay my bills. I worry a lot about this. I'm in poor. I don't have money to give. I don't understand why people like me to have to money taken away. Please stop this injustice to people with disabilities. Please don't squeeze money from working poor people in Oregon. I hope you can see that it is not fair and it is not right. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for testifying today. You did a great job. Thank you. All right. So we have Joanne.
Good morning. Madam Chairperson and members of the committee, my name is Joanne Furman, and I'm the Associate Director of Partnerships and Community Living. We're a private nonprofit that serves people with developmental disabilities in Monmouth. We were in Polk, Marion, and Lynn County in Benton. And I'm here to speak on behalf of the many individuals supported by PCL who, like you and me, go to work every day to earn a monthly income. Ironically, they can't be here today because they had to work. I also have given you Buddy's written testimony. He was here waiting, but he had to leave to get
I'm
to work.
So
and he was really anxious about being late, so he went ahead and left. So I just passed that on to you.
Great.
So he won't be testifying. The people I'm talking about work hard. They, in their prospective positions, and they're very proud of the work they do. However, they're not allowed to retain much of their income due to the current offset system. It's very difficult for those we serve and their families to understand why they have to pay offsets, and it's a huge disincentive to going to work. I can't tell you the number of times I've had to sit and talk to family members and individuals and talk to them about why they're having to pay offsets, why they're working, and at the end of the day have no financial benefit to show for going to work every day. I find myself at a loss for words when I'm confronted with the question, how is this fair? So the truth is it's not fair, and House Bill 2464 takes a step towards fairness. With their permission, I want to take a few minutes to share with you some examples of how the current practice affects people with developmental disabilities. If you don't have a picture, I don't know if you have my testimony,
yes,
but there's some pictures there. This first picture is John. He's really hardworking. He shows up for work every day without fail. He cleans parks in 10 different locations. He works 5 days a week, rain or shine. He's a really great, reliable worker. And he makes an average of about $250 per month, all of which is later returned for an offset payment. On the next page, you'll see Ron. And Ron works in a retail store. He helps stock shelves and greet customers. He's an early riser. He likes to get to work early, so he works mornings 5 days a week. And on average, he makes $200 a month. And once again, offsets, collects, and consumes all of his wages. David likes a variety of work. He holds several part-time jobs, and he's very proud of the work he does and likes to share the success with his coworkers and friends. Again, he makes approximately $200 a month and pays offsets that actually exceeds the amounts of his income. Ron, David, and John want to work. They want to contribute to their communities, enjoy the satisfaction that comes with a good day's work. Unfortunately, regardless of the income they receive each month, they're allowed to keep a little over $100 a month for spending money. The spending money must cover all the things they need throughout the month outside of their room and board. It includes items that they might need in their home, purchase of such basic things as clothing, shoes, personal care supplies. It's also expected to cover the little extras that most working people get to enjoy, like an occasional movie, dinner out, and other recreational items. Some of the losses that come from paying offsets are not nearly as tangible. The self-esteem that a person gains from receiving a paycheck is immeasurable. And we're constantly communicating that people, regardless of their situation or disability, are worthy of being treated like any other citizen. When we are told they must return the money which they worked so hard to earn, that message gets lost. With that in mind, we ask you to support House Bill 2464. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, colleagues. We're going to be continuing this hearing in the future. We have Brian DeLashmet and Catherine White, who also want to testify. So, unless you've got some quick questions. Okay, I know that. I know. Wait. What I'm trying to say is that if we have questions, what I'd probably like, unless you have to ask somebody right here, I would prefer maybe that you ask them of those two folks when they come back, if that's okay. Mm-hmm. And I know I've got one more person who wants to speak, and I will be allowing that. But we will be having more testimony on this later. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for coming, and thank you for all the work that you do. Okay, and we have a gentleman here, and we don't know your name, sir, so if you would come up and give us your name, we would be so delighted. And then we also have Deanna, is it Hartug? Okay, would you be willing to come back at a later time? Great. Thank you so much. We're so glad you came today. Can you give us your name?
Kyle Compton.
Kyle, we're so glad to see you.
Thank you. I need work. I just want to get some money.
Of course.
And so I don't want to get taxes and everything. I don't know, whatever.
Do you want me to read your prepared statement?
Yeah, please.
Okay. Kyle has a prepared statement that I'd like to read. It says, on the roll, committee chairperson and committee members. My name is Kyle. I do not get a lot of money, and because I have to pay an offset, I do not get to do the things others get to do. I would like to buy new clothes when my clothes get worn. I would like to be able to afford an evening out when I just need to get away from home. Occasionally, I would like to treat myself to some same sort of things others do because I have worked hard and I deserve it. I do not like having my money taken away from me. I don't like working for nothing. Nobody does.
That's a great statement, Kyle. Do you have anything to add to that?
What Did you say, what did you say?
I asked if you had anything to add to that, and what I would like to hear, Kyle, is where you work.
Yes.
Garden.
At Garden.
Garden Foundation.
Great. Good. That's great. Well, we appreciate you coming. Let me see if anybody has any questions, and it doesn't seem so. But we really appreciate you coming today, and we appreciate all the work that you've done.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Do you have anything else to say?
No, but I need...
He needs money. He
right.
loves money.
Right.
We understand that completely, Kyle.
We all do.
Kyle. Yes, we all do.
Yeah.
Yes.
Time to get that extra money.
Yes. We really appreciate you coming, and we hope that you get a little tour around the Capitol today. Thank you for coming. Thank you for testifying.
Thank you. That's
good. And this is official notice that I'm going to continue the public hearing on 2464 this Friday, February 9th, and we will also have a work session. So I will temporarily close the public hearing on 2464. Thank you all for coming. All right, now we are back to House Bill 2372. I'm opening up a public hearing on 2372, and I want to hear from Andy Markell, Mary Lou Henrich.
It's frustrating.
And Cynthia Goodmohab. Am I pronouncing that even remotely close?
Mary Lou is quick on her feet this morning.
And we've got enough time, but if you could not repeat what we've heard in the past, even if you have written testimony, if you that would be very helpful. We have other people who want to testify too. And isn't that great? You're color coordinated. All three of you.
I noticed that. I wondered if you... Did you send out a memo?
Yeah, no, this is a camera moment.
Okay. Okay, I'll start, if that's okay.
Sure.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Andy Markell, and I'm a neonatal dietitian. I work at Legacy Emmanuel Children's Hospital. I'm also a board member for the Oregon Dietetic Association. I support House Bill 2372, and the Oregon Dietetic Association Board unanimously supports House Bill 2372. I manage the nutritional needs of sick and premature infants in an intensive care unit. Our babies are born up to 4 months premature before their due date and usually have difficult and complicated hospital courses. My job is to help babies grow despite their illnesses, and I do that exclusively with breast milk and formula. As an infant dietitian, I see firsthand the importance of breast milk in the life of a child. And I won't go over the things that we've talked about already, but I can specifically say in the NICU, breast milk can be a matter of life and death. There are some diseases that breast milk can prevent, specifically necrotizing enterocolitis is a disease that destroys the gut and can kill up to 40% of babies affected. And those that don't die can have double or triple their length of time in the hospital and can also suffer lifelong complications. And breast milk does prevent this disease. Even in the high-tech NICU, everyone recognizes that breast milk is the best thing for our infants. And believe me, even if we could make something better, if we could make something better, we would, but we can't. We've all heard of the increased IQ points for babies who are breastfed. Think about how important those IQ points can be for babies who have a high risk of having developmental delay. I think we all know that breast milk keeps healthy babies healthier, and I won't go into that part of my testimony. And the doctor said earlier today that the American Academy of Pediatrics, and I'll add that the American Dietetic Association, both take the position that breast milk is the best thing for infants and make recommendations about infants receiving breast milk in the first year of life. We used to think that formula was equal to breast milk, but that's just not the case anymore. Experts agree that it's the best. So I don't think that today the question is if breast milk is important for our infants. I think we all know that that's the case. I think the question is how we're going to get this important nutrient to our infants and our communities where consistent breastfeeding is not possible. In the neonatal intensive care unit, mothers are separated from their babies for months at a time, and it's very easy to see the importance of pumping. Pumping is the only way to maintain a milk supply when mothers are separated from their babies. When milk is taken out of the breast, either by a baby or by a pump, the brain knows to make more milk. When milk is not taken out of the breast, the brain knows to stop making milk.
When the brain and breast don't know that there's a baby waiting at home or a baby in the hospital that would love to have that milk hours later when the mom can get to the baby, the brain and breast just know that if no one is taking milk out, there's no reason to make more. This is a fact. In the NICU, 90% of our moms pump milk for their or provide breast milk for their babies, and 100% of these moms have to pump at some part of their baby's hospitalization. Some even pump for the entire first year of their baby's life. Moms who are not pumping enough milk for their baby, one of the tools that we use is to look at a pumping diary, because babies eat every 2 to 4 hours on average, and a mom needs to pump if the baby is not going to take the milk from the breast every 2 to 4 hours. So for a mom to have a full milk supply, she must pump just like a baby would eat. In summary, breast milk is the best nutritional start for an infant, experts agree. My position, or to maintain a milk supply, in the absence of a baby, a mom must pump. So my position as an expert in infant nutrition and a member of the Oregon Dietetic Association Board is to support House Bill 2372. Because without promoting a mom's ability, a working mom's ability to pump, we're not really promoting breast milk. Either healthy or sick, every baby in our community should have a chance to receive breast milk. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer some questions.
Thank you very much. Any quick questions?
Yeah, I have a question, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Andy, just a really quick question, going back to your, the first page and the one disease that you identified, I'll call it NE.
NEC,
okay, yeah. NEC. The what generally is the length of time period that a baby should receive breast milk in order to combat that and prevent that from occurring?
Well, I think in the neonatal intensive care unit, oftentimes there's early onset NEC and then there's later onset NEC that has to do with infection. And breast milk specifically protects against infection. So some of our babies can get this disease in the very first few weeks of life, and then a smaller percentage of babies can get this later in their hospitalization. So if an average hospitalization for a very premature infant would be 4 months, a baby could get it as late as 3 months into their hospital stay, and then their hospital stay would be extended. And we've actually had babies in our NICU, I can say from my personal experience, that have had to stay in the NICU almost their entire first year of life because of this illness. I mean, it's a very, very serious illness.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you very much. Any further questions for Representative Maurer?
Yes, ma'am. Quick question. Is there any thought to just saying, you know, requiring women to breastfeed?
Well, I mean, in the NICU, I can say that our physicians talk to our moms that they're able to see prenatally. They don't get to see all the moms. Some of our moms have to come in emergently and deliver. But our moms that are having premature labor and are in the hospital, our physicians make it a point to talk to the moms and tell them how important breast milk is for their babies. And we have a lot of moms who say that they were not planning on breastfeeding their baby, but once they realize the importance of breast milk for a premature baby, and it is very important, then they changed their mind and decided to breastfeed. And some of our moms don't want to breastfeed at all, so they only pump the milk and they never try to breastfeed their baby. They only want to give breast milk to their baby because it's that important.
One last, I think it's important. I'm going to ask you a question because I think it's important to know the answers. Basically, when the baby stops, either you stop breastfeeding or stop pumping, the faucet's turned off in a matter of hours. This is not a day, 3 days, a week later your brain says no.
Yeah, your brain, especially, you know, some moms, it will happen sooner than other moms. Everyone's body is different. But, I mean, really skipping one pumping for our moms can be really, really detrimental to their milk supply.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Tomei, good morning, Chairwoman Tomei and members of the committee. My name is Mary Lou Henrich, and I'm currently the Executive Director of Community Health Partnership, Oregon's Public Health Institute, which is a small nonprofit public health advocacy organization currently focused on the prevention of childhood obesity. I'm also a public health nurse and also on the health policy cabinet of the Oregon Nurses Association. So I'm kind of here from various hats. I'm here to request your support for House Bill 2372, which will improve the health of mothers and children by supporting breastfeeding. As you know, I am committed to improving the health of all Oregon's children and believe steps must be taken to fight the ever-growing childhood obesity epidemic.
We recognize that the epidemic of childhood obesity is a serious health concern that undermines the future of Oregon's children, and in fact, all of us in Oregon, the economy especially. The negative health effects of obesity, which lead to diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure, some cancers, and issues affecting self-image, undermine work productivity and lifespan. Obesity not only shortchanges individuals, it potentially robs our state of contributions of a healthy citizenry and ultimately costs millions in taxpayer dollars due to preventable illness. We all understand that childhood obesity is a complex issue. As you know, we are working on multiple strategies to encourage healthy weight children, including statewide nutrition standards that actually will be having a press conference this morning at 10:45. But recent research shows another significant step in helping to turn the tide against this epidemic of childhood obesity is to increase sustained breastfeeding for a minimum of the first 6 months of an infant's life and hopefully for a full year. In terms of obesity prevention efforts, we know that children who are not breastfed have higher rates of childhood obesity, and the studies are starting to come out that show that that actually isn't just in childhood, but extends into adolescence and young adulthood. So the newer studies, and I'm responding to Representative Maurer's question, this data is really kind of within the last couple of years, and there are more and more studies going on, and I think the evidence will be mounting to show that breastfed children who are breastfed for at least 6 months will have protective factors against adult obesity. But, like I say, the science is still coming along. The other piece is it also helps the mothers who breastfeed to lose their pregnancy weight gain more quickly, which is an important factor to keep them from also being obese in the long run. So 2372 will help raise breastfeeding duration rates in Oregon by improving workplace conditions for new moms. You've heard this morning that Oregon has the highest percentage of infants exclusively breastfed for 6 months, 26% of all infants. When I heard this statistic nearly 2 years ago, first I heard was, oh, Oregon is number one in the nation, and I was really impressed. When I listened more closely to the winning percentage, however, I was not so impressed. I would be impressed if the percentage was all but 26% of infants were breastfed for the first 6 months of life. That is, 74% of all babies had the health benefits of being breastfed exclusively for those important 6 months. Although many women are aware of the many important health reasons to breastfeed, and we've heard that, you know, we're doing an excellent job of educating them at a lot of different places, what we hear is that many practical barriers are really keeping them from doing that extended 6 months breastfeeding. So while we were hearing some statistics that 88% of women are breastfeeding, you know, start out, and actually it may even be a little higher than that, drops off quite quickly. And when you ask them why, it is because oftentimes of the returning to work issue. So to keep producing the adequate supply of milk, as we've heard, mothers either need to nurse their baby throughout the day, which is not an option for mothers returning to work, or they need to use the breast pump at regular intervals. And many work sites just don't realize the importance of allowing nursing mothers to take that extra 20-minute break. And I do believe that the state has been doing a great job trying to educate businesses and get them to voluntarily do it. But I think that we, you know, the carrot has been out there. I think we need a little bit of a stick. So you are hearing the details this morning from many others, and it's a very practical, economical, and easy to implement workplace breastfeeding support bill that we are totally in support of, because it's got all of the other wonderful physical, psychological, bonding effects that you've heard about. But in addition, the evidence on obesity is really starting to pour in. And I think that business, really, we haven't engaged enough business to understand that we are not going to have a healthy workforce 15 and 20 years from now because of the childhood obesity epidemic, leading to children getting type 2 diabetes early. It takes about 20 years to have the really bad effects of diabetes. And those people will be in their 40s or 45 and really needing to be working when they're going to be facing amputations, blindness. I mean, bad stuff that we haven't really seen come to fruition. And then not only the personal cost, but the overall economic cost and the cost of business when you cannot get healthy people to work for you. So I think that anything, and I'm certainly breastfeeding
is not the silver bullet. Having school nutrition standards is not the silver bullet. I mean, there's a whole broad range of things that need to happen. But I think that we need to come at it from all points, as much as we know and as the evidence starts coming in. And this is definitely one of them, something that, in my mind, would be really a simple thing to implement, to hear Commissioner Gardner speak. I think that we really do need to get on with it this time. So we're strongly supportive, and thank you for letting me talk
thank
to you.
Thank you, Ms. Henrich. Any questions for Ms. Henrich? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for coming, all of you, today. I am strongly supportive of this bill. And when Mary Lou, when you and I had a conversation on the subject, I thought that your explanation of breastfeeding and reaching could you share that with the rest of the committee, because I think I know we're waiting for the evidence to come in on some of the obesity studies, but I think there's just a practical up front that you did very well, and I'd appreciate it if you'd share that.
Chair Tomei, Representative Cowan, the scientific committee, in doing these studies on why is it that children who breastfed into childhood and adolescence and even young adulthood seem to have a protective factor and don't have the obesity problem that bottle-fed babies do. One of the things that is really being studied right now is kind of why is that? Is it causal? Is it just, you know, whatever? But one of the theories is, and it makes such sense to me because I breastfed and then subsequently bottle-fed my children. So, because I went back to work. So, when you breastfeed a baby, you have no idea how much they are consuming. 2, 3, 4 ounces. I mean, they just eat until they're done. And, you know, that's the way it is, and that's the way it was meant to be. When you introduce a bottle, then you put some amount of formula in that bottle. And everyone tells you, you know, don't keep the formula afterwards, throw it away. When I was a young mom and a public health nurse, I mean, I didn't have a lot of extra money. So when I went back to work, was using a bottle, I found myself, I put the 4 ounces or the 6 ounces or whatever it seemed like the pediatrician said now they're going to be eating. And then I would get down to the end of the bottle, and there's about an ounce left. And so you've got to go, come on, come on, and they suck it. Sometimes they spit it out at you. Sometimes they don't. What the theory is that breastfed babies learn from the very first what it is to be full and when you should stop eating. So when you introduce overzealous mothers, fathers, grandmothers, somebody saying, oh, honey, you can take another ounce, we skew and really, from the very beginning, upset that natural ability to know, thank you, I'm full, I'm not going to eat anymore. And I think that makes a lot of sense to me. And I think those are some of the studies now that will start coming out showing that satiety.
That's
they
the
learn
word.
That satiety. Thank you for asking, Representative Cohen.
Madam Chair, but I guess I have a problem with that, because when you breastfeed, you put it into a bottle and you store it. And so your whatever that amount is, and usually you don't store just what you expressed, you pour it in, I mean, because I've done this multiple times with 4 kids, mm-hmm. and so you end up with a full bottle, and then we freeze it, or we, you know, save it, because that's a good thing, mm-hmm. and freeze it, and then you have a full bottle, and again, mm-hmm. you don't want to waste it, so you take the bottle. Mm-hmm. So I guess I see a disconnect. Mm-hmm. If it's, you know, direct breast to child is one thing, but mm-hmm. if you save it, then I think that may not hold water.
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, I understand what you're saying. However, I believe that most of what we're really encouraging mothers to do is to occasionally use the stored or frozen milk. But the point of the pumping is really to keep the producing going on, so that when my daughter's friend did this, she pumped. But then when she came home, she had milk, so she nursed the natural way and only used the stored milk very occasionally when they were going out for a long period or whatever. So I think that you know, I don't disagree that there's some question in methodology and if this is going to be the real answer on why, but I know that this is being studied.
Yeah. Representative Gilliams, sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Several things have come, you know, have occurred to me, so I don't mean to cause you to answer all the questions from the previous witnesses, but you sort of brought a couple of things to my mind. First of all, I'd say that I'm a formula baby, which may be your strongest argument.
So am I.
But when I hear your testimony and you're talking about the state has done a number of things, is coming at it from an education, and you're sort of positive about that, and yet we're at this place of requiring legislation, it concerns me that we're not, I don't know how much we are doing, and I'm interested to know how much more we could do. When I hear a representative from Legacy, I think about incredible institutions we have in Oregon, Legacy being one, Dornbecker being the other, and how powerful that name is in communicating and educating the public. I know that your main job is to take care of babies, but you also, you're here today, and I think you have a great voice in the larger arena. People listen when Legacy and Dornbecker speak up. And then I see we still have testimony from a high-profile law firm that I think, as a glancing at your testimony, exemplary. So my question is, what are we doing, and how can we meet the resistance that we may or may not be seeing from the business community on this without legislation? And maybe you're saying we've done it all, but I just am interested to know more about that.
Chair Tomei, Representative Gilliam, I know that Catherine Bradley from the Department of Human Services Public Health Division is going to speak, and it's within her office where the education program and the breastfeeding-friendly workplace designation program is. So I think Catherine will probably be more appropriate to answer some specific questions. I think in general, however, that this is not an either-or. I think that to get us from 26% of women doing sustained breastfeeding, really the right thing, the best thing for themselves, their babies, and society, up to turning that around and having the 74% I dream of, I think we're going to have to come at it. More education, but that also takes funding. And so we need to look at how to get that information out. There needs to be support for women who start. And when I had a baby, I was in the hospital for 3 or 4 days. That doesn't happen anymore unless you've got a preemie that stays. You're in and out very quickly. Your breast milk doesn't come in. So what I'm hearing from my daughter's friends is that they start in the hospital, they get home, and it maybe isn't quite as easy as they thought. They get scared. Mm-hmm. They need to have support and help on practically how to get through those first few rough days and even sometimes weeks. And we need to look at, is that being that breastfeeding support, lactation support, being paid for by insurance, by, you know, wherever, so that they can get that support they need. So I think it's not just, you know, having it the workplace, but I think it is an important piece. And I just don't, from what I have heard and understand, I don't think that we've got enough businesses just kind of running to doing this without having a little bit of push here.
Would you mind if we did? I've got a list of people.
I don't mind at all.
Oh, I appreciate that. I have a huge list of people. And I know I want to hear you. And I'm wondering if there some people I know are coming from out of town. Is there, Tim, would you mind? We'll continue the public hearing at a future date. Would you mind waiting and testifying later? Is there anybody else who is normally in the building who would be willing? And you are?
Lisa with AOI.
Oh, great, Lisa. Thank you, Lisa. I appreciate that. Is there anybody else who's generally around the building who would be willing to testify at a later date? If people have come from... Yes.
I'm Catherine Bradley, and I'm certainly available to do it at a later date because there are issues that we're having.
Great. Thank you. Because I know we're going to be losing our committee, and I want him to hear as much as possible. Anybody else who's generally in the building? Okay. Thank you, and thank you so much, and I think we'd like to hear your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee,
My name is Cynthia Goodmojab. For the record, I live in Hillsborough. I also wear many hats in the field of breastfeeding, from educator to researcher, international board certified lactation consultant. I'm director of Life Circle Counseling and Consulting, which is a combination mental health care and lactation consulting practice. I'm pleased to be here today to share information with you about why I support House Bill 2372 and why your support of the bill is so important. I've handed you a nice big stack. If you have questions about research, I'll save that for your later homework, I guess. And a lot of things have already been covered. I want to address a couple of specific things that I think are worth a few more words. Representative Maurer, you talked about the carrot and the stick, and that's certainly something very worth considering. What would be the most effective course of action here? Breastfeeding is a very odd health issue. To promote breastfeeding, to promote health via breastfeeding, we are basically undertaking massive cultural change. Massive cultural change is not a speedy process. It takes time to ponder, oh, this is new information. You mean there are benefits of breastfeeding? Well, you know, I didn't breastfeed my child. I wasn't breastfed. I'm okay, aren't I? Or am I not? What do these risks mean to me? Do we even make the connection to risks? Every benefit of breastfeeding actually points to a risk of formula feeding. Which one came first? Breastfeeding. So if we measure against the health outcomes of breastfeeding, we recognize that there's a decrease in health. If we measure against the health outcomes of formula feeding, we see breastfeeding improves health. But we're mammals. So let's measure against breastfeeding and recognize that we are decreasing the health of our population when we're using formula feeding. So we're talking about massive cultural change, and it is absolutely going to require multifaceted action. We cannot just go about this in one way. And if we ask women to wait for the state to catch up with the knowledge that we now have about the risks of formula feeding, then they're going to experience the kind of patchwork approach to breastfeeding support in the workplace that you've heard described today. Some women are, they can make it happen. Some women can't make it happen. Some women are powerful advocates. They're at a, in a powerful position in their company. They are used to advocating. They have skills to advocate in all kinds of other arenas of their life. And they make it happen. Some women are very powerful, and they still can't make it happen. And then we have a large portion of the population that are not powerful, that are not skilled advocates. And they're at the mercy of this patchwork of breastfeeding support in the workplace. If the carrot worked, I think by now we would have more than 50 businesses participating in the voluntary recognition program that Catherine apparently will describe the next time she's here. We only have 50 businesses in the state of Oregon. That is woefully inadequate. And I think it's representative of the fact that when you're talking about the need to have all of these business owners have some kind of deep fundamental paradigm shift to go from formula feeding is okay, it's equivalent, it's that's what my family did, that's what we did, that's what I was formula fed, to, oh, wow, this really matters, and I need to look seriously at this. I need to get over my embarrassment of using the word breast in a conversation with my employee so that I can listen to her and problem solve and come up with solutions. We are not going to have fast action if we go the carrot approach. We have no evidence that it's working in the state of Oregon, and I know so many organizations, institutions that are working so hard to get the message out, and yet we don't have the employers coming in to speak with us, and we can't reach every employer. So legislation is basically going to speed up the help that breastfeeding mothers need to make this happen. Again, it's only when you've got 25 employees or more. It's not going to affect every business in the state of Oregon. But I think if we don't create this legislation, this stronger legislation with a mandate, we're basically saying that this culture lag is okay, that it's okay to continue exposing the babies of Oregon and the women of Oregon, because there's also health risks to women of not breastfeeding, that it's okay to have that continue. And, you know, well, we'll just catch up and we'll get there and we'll continue with our publication, public education efforts. And, you know, when we get there, we get there. We're just going to wait on the carrot. I don't see it happening quickly, and I think this is a serious enough public health issue that legislation that has a mandate is warranted. So There's lots more information in my testimony, and I know you've got so many other things to do.
And you have written testimony presented,
yes.
Right?
So. Yes, yes. So I thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and if somebody wants to submit something in writing to me, some detail about research, I can find things. Let me know.
Is that okay? Do you have a question?
Yeah, I think you make a very good case, and it's got me thinking, but obviously you've thought about this, and I just want to underscore. My question is, is it possible that legislation could have the opposite effect of what you're proposing? That is, increase resistance, not because anybody's against breastfeeding, but because of the political reality that small businesses will resist. Obviously, there's a history here with four times resistance. This bill has failed. I wasn't here for any of that. And I'm just suggesting that it's possible, despite a very good case you make, that with nothing to do with the merits of the issue, businesses, for lots of other reasons, will resist, and we could actually find ourselves having a harder time. I'm just suggesting that.
It's a very good question, Representative Gilliam. We have a variety of states that have already passed this legislation. And one way of kind of keeping a finger on the pulse of what's going on with breastfeeding in the U.S. is compliments of the Internet. You can ask it to send you anything about breastfeeding, anything that's made the news, anything. And I receive those kinds of updates on a daily basis. I have been doing this for quite some time. I know when something hits the news. I know what it's about. I have not heard one word of backlash. And, you know, if there's backlash, you find it in the paper. It's news. So I do not believe that would be the case.
Very helpful.
You know?
Yeah. And if you could perhaps give us the names of the states that do have this bill.
That is in my testimony.
Oh, great.
Yes.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. All right. Thank you, ladies, very much.
Thank you so much.
Okay. We're going to hear from Lori Matiers. Is that correct? Elizabeth Schwartz and Amla Smythe. Am I close? Amelia. You were having to leave?
Yeah, I need to leave in just a few minutes.
It's just a few minutes. We are losing members, obviously. In fact, we won't have a quorum.
You don't need one for the hearing.
So I guess, let's see, we have Kevin Finney. Kevin, any chance you could come by at a later time? Thank you. Lisa said she could. Who else do we have on?
And then she could. She's really good.
Catherine Bradley?
She's good.
Let me run back.
Right. Is there anybody here who cannot come back at a later time?
I could return later.
Could you? Oh, that would be great. It's such important testimony that we're hearing. I just feel bad when the full committee isn't here to hear it.
Yep.
Is there anybody else who could not come back who is here today to testify? All right. Thank you so much. Okay.
We can both come back also. Would that be helpful?
If that would be helpful to the committee, I can certainly come back.
Yeah. Why don't you? Because obviously we've got people who are missing.
Yes, but I would point out that the key members are here.
I can't disagree with that, Representative Gilliam. But we do have so many people, and I apologize that we have lost people, and this I didn't realize that we've got so many people here willing to testify, and we want to hear your testimony. This is such an important issue, and I really appreciate those who have been here, and obviously Diane Garrett, who has just done a phenomenal job both last session and this session. I think it has been a full-time job for her. She has done a fantastic job, and I know you support her as do we on the committee. So if you could come back when we have the full committee, that would be most helpful.
Certainly.
Thank you so much. Do we have a time certain for that? We don't. Okay, but we will announce it as quickly as we can. And I know also that Representative Rosenbaum wanted to testify also, and so he'll get her testimony the last time, too. So any other, let's see, shall I just close the public hearing? Okay, so I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2372, and we will return to this at a future committee session. And we also had noticed
we don't need to do that.
You don't. All right. So we are through with our House Committee on Human Services and Women's Wellness. Thank you all for coming and testifying. Thank you.